I want to invite you to turn to Ruth chapter 4, and that's the last chapter of this book we've been looking at together on Sunday mornings. You'll find it on page 269, if you're not familiar with the layout of the Bible. I also want to say this morning that there are two handouts available. I realize that we've touched on two very sensitive subjects during this series. One of those subjects is the subject of widowhood and the pain that comes with that. And the other subject is the subject of childlessness, which is a very painful subject for a lot of people. And there are two handouts which have come from one of the commentaries which I've been using, which specifically focus on those two issues and take us back to the book of Ruth, and I think you'll find them very helpful. Please feel free to take one as you leave this morning. Well, whether you're a visitor here this morning or not, whether you've been here for the last number of Sunday mornings, we've been working through the Old Testament book of Ruth, which I hope you have in front of you this morning. And as I was reflecting over this short series, I was thinking to myself this morning, what is the big story? What is the big lesson that we need to learn as the people of God from this book? If you were to stand back from it this morning and say, what is the central lesson in this book? Well, we've uncovered some real gems, if you've been here in recent weeks, gems which really point us to the character of God, because in many ways God is the central character in this story, and we've been looking together and we've discovered his sovereignty in this story and how ultimately he's in control of what is going on in this story. We've discovered too, as John Piper puts in his commentary, that God really is plotting for the glory of his people. Sometimes we get very focused in on our circumstances and we lose a sense of the bigger picture, but the Bible tells us, and this book that we've been looking at on Sunday mornings tells us, that God is working out his good purposes for his people. We have to trust that that is the case. Because sometimes our circumstances are so dark and the clouds are so low, as they were for Naomi in chapter 1 in this book, that it seems as if nothing is happening, as if God has gone absent. But we have learned together on Sunday mornings as the people of God that we need to trust God, even when we do not know how the story will work out. We've learned that God walks with us in the darkest of times. And I put in brackets that Sunday morning that we looked at it, even though we may not realize it. But he's here in this story. And we've been looking at the providence of God, God's wonderful provision in terms of how things just work out. Sometimes we don't even see these things happening, but we saw, didn't we, how a whole sequence of events in the book of Ruth just seemed to happen. But it's not coincidence, because God is ultimately in control of this story. But perhaps for me, the biggest theme, the big picture, the big storyline that comes out of this whole story as I stand back from it, comes from something which John Piper says in his commentary. And I think this is super, that the life of the God, the life of those who follow Christ, is not a straight line into glory. Because lives are full of twists and turns, aren't they? Full of ups and downs. But they do get there. I wonder if that's your confidence this morning as a follower of Christ. That no matter what circumstances may be like this morning, or what twists and turns are going on in your life, that is the great Christian hope. We will get there. And that's one of the big lessons that comes out of this story. It's a story full of twists and turns. I found this picture and I was looking for some pictures of a twisty road this morning. It's not a road I particularly would want to travel on. But it, in some ways, helps us to understand the twists and the turns that happen in this story of Ruth that we've been looking at. Just when it seems like we've come to a straight line and things are about to work out, there's another twist and there's another turn in the story. And if you've not been following this story and you're visiting this morning, this is a story which began in Bethlehem with a famine in chapter 1. Bethlehem means the house of bread, except that there was no bread in Bethlehem. And a man named Elimelech makes what I now believe to be a very unwise decision. He takes his family out of the promised land so that they can find work and food in the pagan land of Moab. It makes great economic sense. It's a very practical and pragmatic decision. Only it's a very spiritually foolish decision. He takes his family to a pagan country where he expects his family and his wife, or his wife rather, and his children to grow up. In a place of spiritual isolation where the God of Israel is not worshipped, Elimelech's name means "my God is king." And it's ironic, isn't it, that this man makes these decisions seemingly without any reference to God in his life. And it's a disaster. In Moab, Elimelech dies, and then his two sons die. And finally, his wife Naomi is left with nothing. And so the book of Ruth begins with three funerals. It's a very dark chapter. It begins with three funerals, and the chapter 1 ends with three widows who have no one to look after them and no one to fend for them. And chapter 1 ends with Naomi sitting in the dust saying, "I am empty and I am bitter, and God hates me." But as we come to chapter 4 this morning, we're going to move on from these three funerals and what seems like the end of the family line into chapter 4 and to a wedding. and to a blessing and to a new child being born. It's what we call the providence or the provision of God. The God that can take hopeless things and hopeless situations and can do the most amazing things. But as we've already said this morning, God doesn't take us in straight lines. Life doesn't run in straight lines, much as we would like it to, because we live in a messy, broken world and we are broken people. And yet the story of Ruth makes it clear that through the detours and through the dead ends and through the unwise decisions that are made and through the mistakes and through the failures, God can even take those things and make them and plot them for His glory. And through all of the circumstances of life, there are things that God wants to teach us. And in many ways, that's what the book of Ruth is all about. To help us to see, whether you understand it or realize it or not, that God is at work behind the scenes. Let me remind you of God's providence in Ruth chapter 2. Ruth just happens to pick a field. It just happens to belong to a wealthy man. It just happens to belong to a man who worshipped God. It just happens that Boaz would be the person whom Ruth would eventually marry. And as we shall see this morning, it just happens that through the marriage of Ruth and Boaz comes eventually King David. And then Jesus himself. That's what we call the providence of God. And so Boaz meets Ruth in chapter 2 and prays that God will take Ruth under the protection of his wing. And in God's providence, Boaz becomes the answer to his own prayer. And then just as the story seems to be going on another straight line, there's a problem, because it seems that Ruth and Boaz aren't actually getting together. And Ruth, as we saw last week, forms this risky plan and tries to give God a helping hand and tries to give God a bit of a push. And just as Ruth and Boaz meet together and it seems that they're going to get married, and the road seems to straighten out again, there's another corner, there's another hairpin bend, because we suddenly discovered last week that actually Boaz is not the person who's nearest in line to marry Ruth. And so we come to chapter 4. So you've got chapter 4 in front of you after a slightly longer introduction than usual, although we won't be longer in total, don't worry. We come to Ruth chapter 4. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. And when the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and he sat down. And Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here." And they did so. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders and of my people. If you will not redeem it, if you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so that I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line." "I will redeem it," he said. Then Boaz says, "On the day that you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth, the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." At this, the kinsman redeemer said, "Then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This is how we don't do that today, isn't it? This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it yourself." And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all of the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I've also acquired Ruth, the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses." And the elders and all those at the gate said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together have built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. To the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." So Boaz took Ruth and became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And the woman said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than 7 sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and cared for him. And the woman living there said, "Naomi has a son." And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron was the father of Ram. Ram the father of Abinadab. Abinadab the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David. So, what are we to make of this final chapter as we come to the end of this series on Ruth? You'll know if you've been here on Sunday mornings that often what we've done is we've looked through the story together and then we've sort of applied it at the end. But this morning we're going to do things a little bit differently. We're going to apply this story as we go through. There are four lessons that I want you to see in this final chapter. And the first thing I want you to notice is this, that wherever God is leading in life, there will always be obstacles. There will always be obstacles. These first 12 verses of chapter 4 take us back to the big picture of the book of Ruth. As Boaz looks for ways to fulfill this promise that he has made to Ruth, to redeem her land, it reminds us again that life is messy. It's full of unexpected twists and turns. Just as we expect the path to go straight, we're told in chapter 3, verses 12 and 13, that actually there's somebody else in line to marry Ruth. Look back to chapter 3, and you see what Boaz says. He says, it's true. He says, I am near of kin, he says to Ruth. But he says, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than me. And it's interesting how Boaz responds when he begins to sort of discover that Ruth wants this marriage and that he's the one that she's coming to. He could have sort of said to himself at this point in time, as we may well do, I thought it was God's plan for me to marry Ruth, but actually no, there's somebody else who's in line. Or I wanted it to be God's plan for me, so it didn't work out. But Boaz is a wonderful example of somebody who wants to work through the obstacles which he faces. Now, sometimes obstacles are God's way of turning us in the other direction. It's God's way of showing to us that we are on the wrong path. But there are times, too, when these obstacles are a test, where God is saying to us, this is my will, this is my plan, this is my purpose for you, this is where I'm taking you, this is where you need to go, but you need to learn patience, and you need to hold on, and you need to trust me. And I just love the way this story unfolds. Look at chapter 4 and verse 1. Very first thing in the morning, Boaz says, okay, there's an obstacle. There's somebody else who's near it in line. But I'm going to the city gate. I want to sort this matter out. The city gate in Boaz's day was not just the place that you entered into the town or into the village. It was the most logical place to go if you wanted to spot someone. It was the kind of place where everybody came in and out of the village. It was the government, where the government met. It was a site for important business transactions. And that's where Boaz is heading in verse 1. It says, meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and he sat there. Well, why does he sit there? Because he knows that people are going to be going in and out. And as it happens, almost immediately, he spots this man. The man who is closer in line for marrying Ruth than he is. Verse 1, he says, when the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz says, come over here, my friend. Sit down. We've got some things that we need to work out together. It's interesting. All of the commentaries I've looked at this week refer to this man as Mr. No Name. I actually know who he was, so we're going to call him Mr. No Name this morning. And what happens next takes us back to some very old customs and practices that are completely foreign to us. Taking off your shoe and handing it to somebody else to seal a business transaction. Sitting outside the village or the town gate and transacting land, and with it comes women. I mean, what's this all about? It's very foreign to us. But look how Boaz handles the situation in verse 2. He changes the order of business from marriage to land. Boaz, verse 2, takes 10 of the elders. He says, sit here. They did so. And then he said to the kinsman redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling a piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring this matter to your attention. I thought I should suggest that you buy it in the presence of those seated here, in the presence of the elders and my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so that I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line. And the man says, Mr. No Name, I will redeem it. It looks like a fantastic business deal. He's thinking, well, here's the land that belongs to Naomi. Maybe with a good piece of land. Then he's probably thinking to himself, well, actually, she's an older woman. Maybe she won't live too long. Maybe I won't have to support her for too long. This looks like a great business deal. I could do with increasing my land. I will redeem it, he says. It's almost like he takes out his pen in his pocket. He's about to sign on the dotted line. And then suddenly, Boaz says to him, but hang on a minute. Because, see, up until now, there's no mention of Ruth, is there? He's talked about Naomi's land. And in verse 5, he says to him, but by the way, before you sign on the dotted line, and here's a real test of trust and faith for Boaz, isn't it? On the day that you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth. Now, Ruth has suddenly slipped into the picture here. You acquire a dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. And at verse 6, we suddenly realize that for this man, Mr. No Name, the price is too high to pay. He's not going to go through with it. He says in verse 6, this, the kinsman redeemer says, I can't do it. It might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. He's simply not willing to pay the price. And his unwillingness to pay the price helps us to understand and to see just how sacrificial this was going to be for Boaz. And as the story continues, the deal is signed, isn't it, in verse 8. The sandals are exchanged and the deal is done and the cheers go up and Boaz heads home to get the marriage preparations underway. And in verse 11, there's this wonderful prayer from the elders. Their prayer is for children. The prayer is that God will bless their marriage. There are references to Rachel and Leah in verse 11, who are part of the women who produced many of the sons of Israel. May you have standing, they say. May you be famous in Bethlehem through the offspring the Lord gives you. May this young woman make your family to be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, which is a similar kind of levirate marriage that took place earlier. But there's a problem. Just as it seems as if it's going to work out. Just as it seems like we're hitting another nice stretch of road and they're getting ready to get married, there's another problem. Just as it seems as if the story is going to work out, because their prayer reminds us there's still a dark cloud that hangs over this story. Because if you've been following this story with me back in chapter 1 and verse 4, we have discovered that Ruth is unable to have children. She was married for 10 years and there were no children. So even now, the suspense in the story is not over. We still want to know, how is it going to work out? How is the family line going to continue if Ruth is unable to have children? It's like one of those sort of mountains that you climb sometimes and you think you're almost at the top and you kind of go over the brow and you suddenly realize there's another whole mountain to climb. And then you go over the next brow and there's another part of the mountain to climb. That's what this story has been like. Full of twists and turns and hills that needed to be climbed. But it's true of life, isn't it? We never know what's coming. We never know what's around the next corner. But there is great hope in this story, because as John Piper puts it, as we saw a few minutes ago, he says that the life of the followers of Christ, it's not a straight line into glory. That's what life is like. It's messy. But we will get there. That's the great hope we have as Christians, that there is more to this life that we can touch and feel and sense around us. God is plotting for the glory of his people. He is moving his people towards a new heaven and a new earth, and he uses the circumstances of this life to prepare us. So there's the first lesson I want you to notice from this passage, that wherever God is leading in life, there will always be obstacles. That's what life is like. And secondly, I want you to notice this morning that this is the story that points us to the signpost of God's mercy in our lives. Look at verse 13. Interesting to notice that in this verse, that through the mercy of God, this final dark cloud breaks. Boaz takes Ruth, she became his wife, then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And then something very remarkable happens in this story. I want you to look at verses 14, 15, 16, and see how the tension changes. The attention changes suddenly from Ruth, who has had this child, and we suddenly find that we're reading about Naomi again. As you get to verse 17, the women in the town actually say this. They say, Naomi has had a son. What's this all about? We thought it was Ruth who just had the little baby. And at the end of the story, we're now being told, actually, we need to think about Ruth, about Naomi again. And why do we need to think about Naomi again? Well, I think the narrator of the story wants us to stop and to look back and to just notice how God has been at work in Naomi's life. From the emptiness of verse 1 to the fullness of chapter 4. From the death of chapter 1 to the new life of chapter 4. You see, this is a book that was written to encourage us. Like the way John Piper puts it, he says, talking in verse 17 of chapter 4, he says, verse 17 is the great destination of Naomi's long and twisted road. It may well have been at the end of chapter 1, as Ruth says, you know, God sent me away full and I've come back empty. But it's a sobering reminder to all of us this morning that the complaints that we may have against God will always prove to be untrue. Naomi just didn't see the signposts of God's grace. There will be times when we can see those signposts more clearly than others. She couldn't see them in chapter 1. She could see them in chapter 2 and 3 and 4. Just look at some of the signposts that appear in this story. Here's Naomi, where the bottom falls out of her world. It looks like everything is hopeless. And into that hopelessness, God gives her Ruth, who says to her, "Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. I will keep this promise until the day that I die." Secondly, when Naomi can think of no living relative to provide for her back in Bethlehem, what does God do? God gives her the gift of Boaz, somebody who can provide for her needs. Signpost of God's grace. Thirdly, in chapter 3, or chapter 4 rather, when Ruth marries Boaz, God gives her the gift of a child. And through that, her family line can continue. So again and again in this book, God was at work in the bitter setbacks of Naomi. When she lost her husband and her sons, he gave her Ruth. When it seemed that there was no living relative in Bethlehem, God gives her Boaz. When it seems that there's no way that their family line is going to continue, Ruth has this son through which Naomi's family line can continue. Signposts of God's grace and mercy. And we need to look out for them in the twists and the turns of life. Sometimes we may need to look back in order to see them as clearly as Naomi does. Sometimes they will appear like they do in chapters 2 and 4, and it just sort of pops out and says, "That's God's grace in my life." But there will be times when the clouds are dark and the way is hard. And as Naomi's experience in chapter 1, she could see no sign of God at work in her life at all. But make no mistake about it. We have a God who is working out the good purposes for his ultimate benefit in the lives of his people. Thirdly, I want you to notice in this story that this is something which calls us both as men and women to step up to the mark. We've been concentrating very much on Ruth and Naomi in these stories on Sunday mornings, and particularly about Ruth, a remarkable woman who sets a wonderful godly example for us to follow. But I believe chapter 4 also has something important to say to us as men this morning, particularly to men who have family responsibilities. And I'm going to be honest with you, I feel the challenge of what I'm going to say next to you very strongly this morning. I feel it personally. There are three types of men who appear in this story. The first thing is Elimelech. Elimelech was somebody who led his family with little or no reference to God. He's the kind of man that makes pragmatic and practical decisions without thinking about the consequences. He takes his family deliberately from the promised land to a pagan country where God is not worshipped and doesn't consider the spiritual well-being of his wife or his children. And Elimelech is the kind of man who leaves disasters that ensue for others to pick up. And then there are families, or then there are men rather, like Mr. No Name, which is best we can call him this morning, but they are men who shirk their responsibilities. This man knew what he should have done in this final chapter. It was very clear. But he said, "It's just too much for me. It's too sacrificial. The cost is too high. I'm stepping back from my responsibilities." And men like that are essentially selfish and self-centered, and like the man in this story, more concerned with looking after themselves, and in the case of this man, looking after his own estate. If you're a man this morning with family responsibilities, do you sense the challenge of this passage? Because you see, it's a passage which actually points us to Boaz, isn't it? A man of standing. What have we discovered about him? He's a God-saturated man. He's a man who takes God into the workplace. He's a man who takes his responsibilities seriously. He picks up the mess that other people have left. And that kind of man is the kind of man that Christian men are called to imitate. A man who is godly. A man who is biblical. A man who takes his family responsibilities seriously. A man who values the place and the role of women and at home as well as in the workplace. A man who wants to provide. A man who wants to protect. A man whose life is marked by prayer. And this story, I believe, calls us as Christian men to be like Boaz. Am I the only one who feels the weight of that responsibility this morning? I expect not. But it's a story that calls us to step up to the mark as Christian men, to work through the obstacles, not to run away, to recognize, as we've seen this morning, that life is not a straight line to glory. There's the call to Christian men this morning from this passage. And finally, I want you to notice this morning that this is a God-sized story. As John Piper puts it again, sorry to refer to him a lot this morning, but he really unpacks this story well. He makes this really important point. He says, if this story simply ended in verse 16, in a little Judean village with an old grandmother hugging a new grandson, glory would be too big a word. But the author doesn't leave it there. He lifts his eyes to the forests and the mountain snows of redemptive history. You see, this really is a God-sized story because in verse 17 we are told that this child, Obed, was the father of Jesse and Jesse is the father of David. And all of a sudden we begin to realize there's something much greater has been going on in this story all the time. It's as if the story suddenly explodes when you get to verse 17 of this chapter. Suddenly we realize that behind the scenes, God has been working out a much bigger picture. He was preparing the way for the greatest king that Israel had ever known. You think Naomi had any idea of that in chapter 1? Of course she didn't. The darkness of her circumstances seemed like her world had ended. But God was up to something much bigger. King David, who would pave the way for Jesus Christ, who would become the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who would announce the arrival of a new kingdom and a new age, which ultimately would lead to a new heaven and a new earth. You see how this story explodes as you get to the end of chapter 4. Of a new kingdom where there would be no more pain and no more death and no more crying, and the old order of things will have passed away. This little story of Ruth suddenly opens up into a great river of hope. So no matter how dark your circumstances may be this morning, no matter how tight some of those twists and turns may be, don't lose sight of what God is up to. When you stand back from this story, you really do begin to discover that the best really is yet to come. As this story just explodes at the end, you begin to realize, yes, God is plotting for the benefit of his people. God is plotting for the good of his people. God is working his good purposes out. And to the unshakable truth that all those who trust in Christ will experience this great hope. Can I say to those of you who are younger this morning and starting out in life, when it might feel like the world is your oyster, the best is yet to come. Can I say to those of you who are older and maybe moving towards the end of your lives, the best is yet to come. And here's a little story that took place over 3,000 years ago, given to us by God, which is designed to anchor us to someone who is far greater than we are. We started our reading this morning by saying, to me, your thoughts are not our thoughts, God. Your ways are not our ways. This story anchors us to someone who is greater than we are and gives us hope in the darkest of times and the most difficult of places and frees us from some of the trivial pursuits that we just seem to embark on so easily but never satisfy us. This is a story that calls us to live in the light of the coming and the return of Jesus Christ. And so I hope that this story of Ruth has encouraged you on these Sunday mornings. I hope it's challenged you. And here are the lessons of the final chapter. There are some of the big pictures, or the big picture rather, of John Piper says, look here, this is how it is. This is life. Life is not about straight lines. Sometimes we just wish, don't we, that God would just sort of zap us out of this life when things get hard and take us to heaven. But that's not how life works. But as Christians, we have a great hope that the best is yet to come. The lessons from this story, that wherever God is leading you in life, there will always be obstacles. Sometimes those obstacles or to direct you in a different path. Sometimes God is saying to you, you need to work through those obstacles. You need to trust me. You need to put your faith in me. And together we will work through these difficulties. Here's a story that points us to the signpost of God's mercy in our lives. Sometimes you will not see it. Sometimes the clouds will be so dark and the road will be so difficult to see that you will say, where is God in these circumstances? But he's there. Just as Ruth is able to observe as she looks back, so you can see that God has been at work in her life. Here's a story that calls both men and women to step up to the mark. Whether you're a Ruth or whether you're a Boaz this morning, that's the example we're called to follow. And finally, to recognize that this is a God-sized story. No And we need to realize that our lives are about God-sized stories as well. Not just about the story that we're looking at this morning. God is at work in your life, if you're a follower of Christ, to bring all things together in your life for good, whether they're the hard times or the good times. God is plotting for you glory. Let's take a moment to pray.